Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Bottom Up Radio Network.
Good evening.
This is Rabble Rouser here.
This is G20.
And tonight we got a very special guest coming up. We got John Taylor Gatto, and I guess the second guest is Jesus Christ himself, because that was the only other guest we could get to be better than John Taylor Gatto tonight.
Boring.
This dude's been dead for 2,000 years. Let the fucking man sleep. All right, that was The Clash with Know Your Rights, and that's the video. I'm going to throw that link to that video into the chat room. If you're listening in tonight and you're not in the chat room, you can do so by getting an account or not. I don't really care, but the video is pretty awesome to watch, and I want to throw it out to the peeps that made that video. Good job, peeps.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that.
So what's going on, G20? What the fuck's happening in your side of the earth?
Oh, man, it's warm. I'm shirtless. Really hairy.
Like Robin Williams.
Oh, God, it's like a fucking carpet. my wife finally has me peeing sitting down.
Really? Was it the David Rovick song?
Well, it was, you know, kind of a necessity. You know, the one of the little hinges on the toilet seat cover is a little wobbly, so it won't stay open. So natural law forced me to start sitting where I'm peeing, and you know, I don't mind so much.
I've always sat when I pee, and I think it's you know, I started sitting to pee when I was talking to some Bosnian friends of mine, radical little fuckers that they are, and they all squat to pee or shit. They don't sit on a traditional toilet. They make themselves squat, I always asked them why, and they said that it was number one, it's what they do in their house. They've always done it. I don't know if that's a cultural thing. Don't get on my shit for saying that this is a cultural thing, that Bosnians squat to pee. But this is what they did, and they said the reason was it's better for your prostate, and it's a more relaxing way to go. And I can, you know, anybody that's ever shit in the woods knows that squatting to shit is much better, and sitting to pee, anybody who's done it, males, it's more relaxing, takes some time out of your day, and according to David Rovick, it's revolutionary.
You know, I'm just gonna say it's a lot less effort. You know, you can multitask while you do it. It's almost like shitting.
Dude, have you ever tried to pee standing up when you're drunk and you do that one arm on the wall thing, like wobbling over the top of the toilet?
That's
never
awful.
Again.
And then you have to worry about whether you accidentally touch the guy next to you,
or peed on the guy sitting on the toilet that you're trying to pee in. Don't act like
sorry,
it hasn't happened.
Sorry, bro.
Sorry, bro. Do you move your legs?
Are you brushing your teeth or something? What's up? Oh, man,
we're fucking highbrow. People don't know we're high intellect is what we do. That's what we bring to the table.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we're products of our environment, really. And
we
do live in a very intellectually stimulating environment. And that brings us to the headlines. I'm going to see if this song works quietly in the background. If not, I'm just going to turn the song off. Oh, there it is.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's like in the back of your mind, kind of like your dad telling you to wear a rubber when you're halfway through the process of having sex with some dirty girl that you met at the bar. It's in the back of your
mind. You know what I mean?
It's just there, you know. It's there. And then you had to think, why did Dad tell me to wear rubber? He didn't wear rubber. And then you think, wait a minute, that's why he told me to wear a rubber. So what you got on the headlines this week?
All right. The Victorian Advocate reports that the Federal Reserve is already being audited, and there's no reason to. To quote Ben Bernanke, the General Accountability Office, which is supposed to be doing this audit, already looks at virtually all of our activity. The ones it doesn't are financial books, financial loans, and the ones it's not looking at and where the taxpayer needs some assurance, we're willing to work with Congress to make sure it gets the information it needs. What that translates to, good listeners, is that, in fact, nobody is auditing the central bank, because if they were to do that, and to quote Bernanke, the people might lose confidence in the central bank that's ruining all of their lives.
Well, if they knew what we were doing, they probably wouldn't like it. So just never mind.
Here's like a direct quote. I don't think that's consistent with independence. We're completely open to providing any information Congress wants. I don't think the American people want Congress running monetary policy. They already do.
Wait a minute. This is completely contrary to independence, but you are claiming to be a function of the federal economy.
Right.
You know, but, dude, why are you all up in my business? All right? Why are you all up in my business? I mean, I don't tell you how to what you have to spend your money on. I mean, I do, but I don't tell you what to do, right? I mean,
right. What you got, Rabble?
Let's see. I'm going to go with an update report. We talked about some riots in prison systems. They've been occurring all over the U.S. The last few weeks. For some strange reason, those prisoners just aren't happy with their situation, and they've been rioting. So as a punishment and a preventative measure, state appellate court says that the ruling is that smoking will now be banned in all prisons. This started in Kentucky, but this is going to go national. All prisons are not going to have smoking because of the riot, because apparently cigarettes, matches, and lighters had been something used in the riot. Now let's think about this. You got 3,000 pissed off criminals who ain't got shit to do and nowhere to go, so they smoke cigarettes. Take away their cigarettes, and there's still going to be 3,000 pissed off criminals with no place to go and nothing to do.
And now they're jonesing for a smoke.
Right, and now they're fucking pissed. And I'll tell you what, when I run out of cigarettes in the morning and I have to walk my ass the block and a half to get cigarettes, I'm pissed that whole block and a half. I'm ready to kick a cat. The whole block and a half, I'm looking for house cats that are out in the yard to kick them. That's how pissed off I am. Imagine if you were in prison and you're doing a life bid and they take away your cigarettes, you ain't got shit to lose. So this is hilarious to me. They're going to ban smoking in prison because, Travis, it's smoking cigarettes that causes riots.
Think of the children. That's all I got to say, dog.
Exactly. I mean, how does that look to our children when prisoners get to smoke?
Yeah. All right. So
that's from the New York Times, folks.
Bloomberg.com reported that the Bank of Japan's governor has said that central banks should avoid inflating asset bubbles by keeping interest rates low for too long. That's like a McDonald's thing that it turns out eating too much salt can kill you. All right, people, what we need to understand is that what these institutions do is do exactly what he says they shouldn't. That's the only thing that they can do. And again, ruin millions and millions of lives. I'm good. You're next.
Okay. Well, you know what's funny is I've got an update on the smoking ban. It appears that it's also been lifted.
Is that a 10-day ban lift?
Apparently so. Yeah, August 24th, the smoking ban imposed. August 28th, the ban has been lifted. So, yeah. I guess direct action really does work. I'm not even going to throw these links in the chat room because those are ridiculous. You don't need to do that shit.
You know what?
I don't need to prove
it. I think that we were the ones responsible for lifting that ban. So I'm going to say, no problem. No problem, prisoners.
Yeah, see people, this is what democracy looks like, okay? Right here. Show me what democracy looks like. This is what democracy looks like, right here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we didn't need to do no protest. We didn't even need to vote. We just had to say it on air, and Big Brother heard it, and we reasoned with him. You can reason with the power structure. You can reason with fascism.
They're open for dialogue.
Yeah, come on, people. I mean, there's two parties. Duh. Okay, this is no, I can't use that one yet. I'm going to go into this one. Okay, here we go. Schools, this is talking about schools. We're pulling our daughter out of public school. She's been in the public school system for the longest week and 3 days of my life, and she's coming out, and she'll never, and my son will never be a part of the public school system, so fuck you, public school system. And I got a bunch of teacher friends who are all pissy about it. Fuck that. Fuck you, too. If I worked at R.J. Reynolds selling cigarettes, and you told me you quit smoking, and I told you that's a bad idea, that'd probably be because it benefits my job, and it's probably wrong. So if you're a school teacher who's telling me it's a bad idea to homeschool my kid, fuck off, okay? Because I don't really care. Don't want to hear it. Your opinion doesn't matter. If it did, my kid would be in school with you, but it doesn't, so it won't. So people asking why. Here we go. Here's some good news. I'm going to go ahead and throw this one in the chat room as I talk. Schools prepare for H1N1 vaccines. New research suggests vaccinating school children is key to helping control the spread of the H1N virus. The state health department officials, they expect to receive the first 1 million doses of the vaccine by mid-October. So by the middle of the fall this year, students are going to be getting vaccinated, and this is forced. This is a forced vaccination. To stay in school, to remain in the public school system, you will have to receive this vaccination. And I'm going to hear a bunch of people saying, schools, that's where the flu spreads. Okay, fine. Don't go to school. If there's sickness there, don't go. It just makes sense. If I were to tell you that, three out of every five kids piss in the pool, you'd probably stop going to the pool every day. So I'm telling you right now, they're going to vaccinate all the kids, and if you don't want your kid to get the flu, don't send them to fucking school. If you're going to send your kid to school, expect them to get shot up with dope from Baxter. Baxter, by the way, we talked about on previous shows, but for the new listeners, I'll just remind you to go ahead and Google Baxter avian flu virus scandal. Go ahead and Google Baxter and HIV, and then you tell me, after you've done this research on your own, if it's cool that we're doping up our school children with Baxter products.
And I would imagine that they're probably making a significant amount of money off the millions and millions and millions of vaccinations that are going out into the school. Vaccinations that
No. These companies, Baxter, they're giving these things away for free. Yeah.
Oh, like God bless them. Charity matters first.
It's part of being a patriot.
Well, I'm sure Rumsfeld is there at Baxter saying, "Hey, you know what? I love kids. Except yeah. brown ones that live in caves. I don't like them, but I love kids in America."
It was exactly what Cheney did during the Iraq War by giving away all of Halliburton's uses to the military for free because he's a patriot. He didn't profit in the trillions from that war. He gave it away for free, right? Or wait, no. He profited in the trillions. Yeah, Rumsfeld sitting on the board of Baxter, profiting in the millions and billions, and they're probably going to have to make a new term, past trillions and gazillions. Mathematicians, if you're out there, call me, 646-200-3974, and tell us what the highest number of dollar amount is. I don't really give a shit. It's all fake anyway.
But tell us anyway.
Yeah. So what else is going on?
This is a good one. Al Jazeera just reported that toll rises in Pakistan in a new Pakistan drone attack. The toll has risen. Three Pakistan intelligence officers said on Saturday that 21 people have been killed in the attack in the village of Donda Darpa, Kel, in North Waziristan a day earlier. Six kids among the dead. It's unclear whether the bad guy they were after was actually among the dead. And this just goes out to any of you out there who voted for Barack Obama and who have supported this Democratic Congress in the hopes that it would end war. I just want to remind you that Democrats and Barack Obama are in power, and little kids died yesterday, and they don't even know if they got the evil guy they were actually after. I hope that as
a... If I may be so blunt, who gives a shit?
Indeed. I know that I'm probably not touching any of you people because you'll just continue to vote for these thieving fucking murderers anyways. That was completely an exercise in redundancy. Thanks for the time.
Okay. Last one I'm going to throw out there real quick. Since we're talking about school tonight with our guest, John Taylor Gatto, who I guess I could give a really quick lowdown of who Gatto is. Let's see. John Taylor Gatto taught 30 years in public schools before resigning from school teaching on the op-ed pages of the Wall Street Journal. I want to say that again. He resigned on the op-ed pages of the Wall Street Journal. During that year that he resigned, he was named New York State's Official Teacher of the Year. Since then, he has been a tireless advocate for school reform, traveling over 3 million miles to lecture on the subject, blah, 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 blah. His earlier book, Dumbing Us Down, has sold over 100,000 copies. Did that sound like I was reading that? Because I wasn't. That's exactly how I talked.
No, it was totally freeform. Freeform.
And we're going to talk to him tonight about the Bartleby Project, which he'll be unleashing the news on that. So I want to go with this article. Obama proposes longer school days and extended school year. He says we can no longer afford an academic calendar designed when America was a nation of farmers who needed their children at home, plowing the land at the end of each day. That calendar may have once made sense, but today it puts us at a competitive disadvantage. Our children spend over a month less in school than children in South Korea. That is no way to prepare them for a 21st century economy.
That's really good.
Are you fucking kidding me? You know, son, you're lucky that you only go to school for 9 months, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, because children in South Korea, they go for 10 months. Yeah, that's right. So yuck it up, okay? There are children starving in Africa, okay?
Yeah. You're going to school for the next 15 hours. I get the fuck out of my sight.
Yeah, you know, our parents always had those scary school things about, you know, like, I had to walk uphill both ways in the snow. Like, we're going to get to tell our kids, like, oh, shit, you know, you got it rough. I only had to go to school for 9 months out of the year. Thanks to Obama, you got 10 months at least.
Too bad you weren't born back in the dizzy.
So we got a call on line two here from 607. Are you there? Hello, caller?
Hello, caller.
John, is that you?
Yes, that is me.
Yeah.
Hey.
I want to welcome onto the show our guest for tonight. This is John Taylor Gatto. I was talking about him earlier. He's the author of a couple books. You've written a couple books, right, John?
I've one out right now, Weapons of Mass Instruction. It's been out about 4 months, and I hope everyone listening buys it.
I've got a copy right here in my hand, John, and I'm telling you, I wanted to punch anybody that got in my way by page 14. This is the most enraging book I've ever read, and I've read some pretty fucked up books, and this book just pisses me off.
Which part of it grabbed you, artist?
Let's see. The one quote... that really gets me, that I've read repeatedly to friends, is when you quote one of the founding fascists of the 20th century, the Rockefeller General Education Board's occasional letter number one.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
That's a classic.
Can I go ahead and read this quote for people?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, this is from the pages of Rockefeller General Education Board's letters. This is a 1906 document. This is documented in the book Weapons of Mass Instruction. He cites it from the 1906 document called Occasional Letter Number One. That sounds so sweet, you know?
It does sound nice. It sounds like a greeting card.
Yeah, well, an occasional letter, you know? In our dreams, people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. The present educational conventions of intellectual and moral education fade from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work with our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from among them authors, educators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, or statesmen, of whom we have an ample supply. And I stress the word we there for a reason. Of whom we have an ample supply. The task we set before ourselves is very simple. We will organize children and teach them to do, in a perfect way, the things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way.
What do you want to do tonight?
The same thing we do every night. Try to take over the world.
So that's the quote, John, that really pissed me off.
How'd you like Woodrow Wilson's? We want a small group to have a liberal education, a much larger group to train themselves for, I forget the exact wording, specific manual tasks.
Well, I can tell you the exact wording.
You start looking for this stuff, it's all over the surface of things. It's simply that we're conditioned not to look and to assume that someone means the best for us. They may make a few, you know, slight errors here and there, but at bottom, we're all people of goodwill. Nobody wants to hurt kids.
Well, you know, I think that one of the major tools with that is how absolutely sweet the image of the school teacher is. And you talk about this, that this is even above and beyond the heads of the school teachers that this is happening, that school teachers aren't even aware that they're indoctrinating and imprisoning our children.
No, of course not, and neither do the lion's share of school administrators. It's simply a pretty good job, pretty steady, good medical benefits, early retirement, you know. And by asking questions, you only make trouble for yourself, or you're pushed out of the business there. So it really runs very mechanically, with nobody challenging much of anything except petty stuff like, do we teach phonics or whole word? Nonsense questions.
John, in your book, you also note that boredom is the common condition of school teachers. What do you think it is, John, that causes such a symptom within the system?
Well, the heart of this mechanism is the type of economy we have, which requires, since we have machines that work around the clock, it requires people to buy around the clock, and when they're out of money, to mortgage their futures and continue to buy. The best way to drive people into paroxysms of consumption is to bore them. I mean, you can titillate them with advertising, but if they're bored, they'll do the job for themselves. You know, shop till you drop. You know, it's odd. It sounds like, you know, I'm playing the wise guy critic, but in truth, in policy meetings prior to the turn of the century, these were the items discussed because, I'm so exasperated. The major names in human history did not believe such a thing as education was possible, that it was romantic nonsense. You could school people, by which you mean you could train them in habits and attitudes, but people were fixed pretty precisely where they were at birth. Let me give you a few names, because some of them ought to surprise you. The great liberal philosopher, Benedict Spinoza. I know he's called Baruch Spinoza, but he never called himself that, not even once in his whole life. Spinoza wrote a book heavily read in the United States and all over Europe in 1690, in which he said we have to have a universal institution of forced schooling, because the vast majority of ordinary people are murderously irrational. So we got to get them into these confinement containers, and we have to confuse them so badly they won't know which way is up, which way is down. We'll set them into permanent competition with one another, so they'll stay out of our hair, the few rational people. Now let's talk about that for a second. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, will you explain to people, first of all, the difference between education and schooling, but more so, when you say irrational, that we've been taught so much that to be irrational is to be bad, and that any idealistic ideas that we have for embetterment of our communities or our lives are generally called, well, that's just irrational, especially being anarchists. Anarchism is, that's just irrational. Well, yeah, sure, it's irrational. Who fucking cares? It's better. What is ration? What is rationale?
Well, you may want to ask yourself, and then I will jump into that, but you may want to ask yourself why every American university ranks Spinoza as one of the great liberal philosophers in human history. He's not a bad guy. He's one of the very best guys. Now, they don't mention his tractate, which is the book I was referring to, published in 1690, rational, irrational is the same kind of dichotomy that John Calvin, the great religious philosopher of
Calvin and Hobbes fame.
Yeah, right.
No, please go ahead. I'm sorry. I did tell you this had a comedy aspect to it.
I'm not yet used to you guys' rhythm, so it's
that's okay.
An old codger. No, it's fine. Just be yourself. But Calvin, who easily is the most important high level voice affecting American society, maybe one of the top three in all history. I mean, Calvin creates New England, for example, and New England creates the rest of the United States by creating the Civil War. But back to Calvin. Calvin said that there's no such thing as sin and redemption. He said everybody's equally a sinner, but the Lord has selected a group of elected people, and he called them the elect, to get salvation regardless of what they do. They can murder their mother. They can make war against countries that can't afford a pair of shoes. It doesn't matter. They're justified sinners. So
would it be that Calvin was one of them that was picked to be a justified sinner?
Well, the justified sinners knew who they were. The Puritans were justified sinners. And they were allowed to shoot the Indians down after the Indians had kept them alive, because it doesn't matter. In fact, this is probably the most important thing I'll have to say in my life. You can trace all the way from Plato right up to the present day, with a main stop of John Dewey and William James at Harvard and Oliver Wendell Holmes in the Supreme Court, you can trace this identical point of view, sometimes stated philosophically, sometimes religiously, Charles Darwin's case, it's stated biologically, and Darwin may be the most important detrimental influence on modern history that ever existed, because Darwin simply said in Descent of Man, so any of your skeptical listeners, I'm not talking about evolution here, I don't give a shit about evolution, whether it is or isn't, there is not important. What's important is that one of the wealthiest men in the world, Charles Darwin, you don't read that in the history books, do you? Who palled around with princes and dukes And so if he could impress them with a point of view, it would spread instantaneously through nations like Japan. Darwin said in Descent of Man, published in the U.S. in 1871, that only a small number of people, none of them Irish. I know that sounds funny, but the Irish were at the top of his list. Are evolving. Irish people aren't evolving at all. And if they crossbreed, can you imagine if schools actually taught what Darwin said? If the people who are evolutionary dead ends crossbreed with the good stuff, which are basically blonde Scandinavians and blonde English people, evolution will march backwards into the swirling mist of the dawnless past. That's pretty strong language.
Jesus.
Pretty poetic, right. Too, actually, I got to say.
Yeah, well worded. I mean, I'll give
them
that. I
want both of you, if there's two of you there, if there's 10 of you there, I want all 10 of you, to try to imagine yourself as salt of the earth, pillars of the economy and the society, wherever you are. If you now believe this, and of course you do believe it, there, what are you going to do to defend your blonde, blue-eyed daughter from the Irish pig who's primitive and not evolving? What are you going to do? You're going to set up sorting mechanisms. You see it in a crude sense in public school where you have gifted and talented honors kids who don't associate with gifted and talented kids, who don't associate with special progress kids, who don't associate with mainstream kids, and the mainstream A kids don't associate with the mainstream B, C, D, or E kids. And then you have, down in the sewer, special education. You have a class system being perpetuated. It's exactly like a caste system in India, but it's being perpetuated by the little red schoolhouse on your corner. And that's only one of the mechanisms. Another would be the officer separation from enlisted men in the Army, and then the field grade officer separation from the...
So you're talking about institutionalizing hierarchy from the earliest point that the state or who... In this case, it is the state, can get a hold of your children. They teach your children where they fit in the hierarchical ladder.
They teach them early enough that no matter how much intelligent contradiction of that you can add to your kid, it's the rare person who actually believes it. If you're inferior, you're inferior. Now, with Darwin, you're biologically inferior, and there's no way out of the trap. With Spinoza, you're psychologically inferior, and there's no way out of the trap. With Calvin, you're religiously inferior, and there's no way out of the trap. I mean, we have these people in a direct line at the very top of the intellectual pyramid of Western society from the beginning right up till today. And some of the great heroes that you're sold in elementary, Oliver Wendell Holmes, nobody bothers to read what Holmes actually said. He said there is no such thing as law or justice. It's what the strongest people say it is. That's the definition of justice. Law based on legal precedent is for the morons to believe in, the strongest people. That's Oliver Wendell Holmes.
And, John, you know, I think that nobody knows that or understands that more than...
Because you don't read. You know,
right. Well, nobody understands that more than the poor black and Hispanic community of the United States. They understand clearly there's no justice, that justice is strength wins. Right.
They're the wrong color. I like everybody else, I had my heart set on a Chicago street organizer as president, and he's certainly the most beautiful speaker I ever heard in my life. But his first job in office isn't to get us out of Iraq, which I think is why he got elected. It's to pass out several $1 trillion to the wealthiest people in the world, that your grandchildren will still be paying off that debt.
You know, that, John, that was, that, I'm sorry, that that just that leads me into a question that I've been wanting to ask you, because as I've been telling friends about the show this week, oftentimes what's the response to the problem of public education becomes one of political parties, where it's like, well, you see, the Republicans fucked up our education years ago. And I wanted to ask you, John, based on your experiences and 30 years of teaching within the public system, do you think it's as easy as picking out a political party as the responsible party, or is it possible that everyone's the...
Not at all, and I don't mean to be a wise ass. They're the same party. Look at who donates to the campaign. They're the same party. You know, it's a mono party, and it does not matter who you got in office there. I'd rather have had Bush than Mr. Gore, who had nothing to do with his film, by the way. I hope nobody's naive enough to believe that Al Gore actually made a film about global warming. I don't know who made it. Al put his name on it, and he got the Nobel Peace Prize for it. The reason I like Bush better than Gore is it's obvious who Bush was.
Exactly.
Gore would have continued the job that Bill Clinton started, you know, talking sincerely. Oh, good God. Back to your question, which I forgot.
Well, hold on, John. Before we move on past this idea, you brought up the Grand Wizard himself, and you said you had your heart set on this president from Chicago, the street organizer from Chicago making changes. Now, we've established that the school system in this country is designed the school system is designed to put you into a caste system, to keep you in reps. I'm going to play a clip right now. I'm going to play a couple clips in a row, actually. This is President Obama addressing Congress. So let me just play this, and let's I want your thoughts on what he says. Here we go.
Coming right up.
Begin college, never finish. This is a prescription for economic decline, because we know the countries that outteach us today will outcompete us tomorrow. That is why it will be the goal of this administration to ensure that every child has access to a complete and competitive education from the day they are born to the day they begin a career.
From the day they are born until the day they enter a career. Next segment. This is important too. This is the same speech. I'm just skipping forward a little bit. The same speech.
Education or career training. This can be a community.
Hold on, my computer's. The man's got a hold of my computer right now.
Or 4-year school.
Hold on, let me rewind this. We'll let this load for a second. So what he said in the first one is that they're going to ensure that every child will be in school or have the educational system in their lives from birth until they enter a career field, which you talk about a lot in Weapons of Mass Instruction, about how school is used as a preparation for production and consumption.
Fundamentally, it's the largest employer in our society by far, and it spends more money and it provides more jobs that are sinecure jobs that can be political patronage. I mean, if you think of it as a business first, an awful lot of the anguish falls away. Anger may replace the anguish. What Mr. Obama is saying has been, A, the UFT, the union party line, since Al Shanker's day, almost the same words, but much more diabolical. It's Bill Gates' famous speech of, I think, 3 years ago in January to all 50 governors of the 50 American states. Mr. Gates said that it ought to be a national priority to absolutely turn schooling into a college prep program and to underwrite every single student in the United States to go to college. Now, I was in Holland speaking over there, and I made front pages of the Dutch newspapers, and I couldn't help myself from literally laughing out loud because Bill Gates is one of the many, many movers and shakers who didn't bother to go to college himself. And after he got 30 or 40 or 50 billion dollars, whatever he had, he never bothered to go back either. So if you want to judge him by his actions rather than his words, he's exactly like Steve Jobs of Apple, or Steve Wozniak of Apple, or Gates' own partner, Paul Allen. None of them went to college. And how about Michael Dell? He didn't go to college either. Said it was a waste of time. How about Warren Avis, who's given a choice of going to college or a state to set up the first auto rental at airports? Guess which one he took. How about Ted Turner, who has the only international television channel right now? He didn't go to college. He said it was a waste of time. You know, we can go a lot farther with this. But
so could it be possible this is why they want us to go to college? And on that note, before we answer that.
Have you ever seen the way school students use computers? I mean, you've got a guaranteed breakage. It's just a golden parachute. The larger the school population, the more broken computers. I was just looking at 60 Minutes tonight. I hope you saw it, where the most polluted area on planet Earth was receiving American computers and cell phones and breaking them up into their deadly toxic components. Everybody in the area has a variety of cancers, but they're paid $8 an hour, so they can't afford to leave that productive work, which is breaking up our deadly instrumentation, which naturally you can't live without, right? You got to have the iPhone and the J phone and the K phone. Why? There's almost no one left who knows how to assemble an argument, or even a sentence.
Anyway. On that note, I'm going to use some of this technology to play another quick clip of Barack Obama, same speech. Listen to what he says now. First, he said that we're going to get them from birth until they enter the career force. All right, and this is what he says about anybody in your book. By the way, I want to mention this to everybody. I'm a high school dropout, proudly, and Weapons of Mass Instruction is dedicated to high school dropouts. There's all through the book is sprinkled with segments of basically success stories. I don't want to say success stories though, because and I want to talk about this later, but these are people who have reached levels of American economic achievement and historical achievement, and they never went to school. That's what he has all through Weapons of Mass Instruction, using these as examples of people who have not used school system and have come into power of some sort. But I want to play this clip and see what you think about this. In your premise that high school dropouts have become more successful, or school dropouts, period, have become more successful in a lot of ways. Check this out.
Education or career training.
Oh, I hate you.
It can be a community college or a four-year school. Vocational training or an apprenticeship. But whatever the training may be, every American will need to get more than a high school diploma. And dropping out of high school is no longer an option. It's not just quitting on yourself, it's quitting on your country. And this country needs and values the talents of every American.
So there will be no more high school dropouts. It's not going to be allowed, because quitting school is quitting on your country. What do you think about that, Mr. Gatto?
Well, I think what he ought to do is order the FBI and the CIA to snatch Gates and company out of their offices and put them. But they're bad examples, aren't they? Whole pack of them.
And forget those whole founding fathers.
Yeah. Oh, Lord.
I think also, you know, one of the warning signs should be, you know, any system that from the very beginning you're pledging allegiance to a flag. Should be the red flag that the that something nefarious is going on. I mean, what's that got to do with learning anything? What's that got to do with enriching yourself? John, do you think that there is a lot of aim towards also building individuals to populate the government's war machine?
Well, look, our economy cannot function without a war situation. Now, oddly enough, about 30 or 40 years ago, this was an item of national conversation. Now, when we went back around 1960, there was a wonderful two-part article, I recall, in Atlantic Monthly, and the question was, can the economy actually function without building weapons and funding intelligence and all the rest of the package of things, you know, uniforms, hats, all of it? And the answer was no, it can't. It must be clear that the minute we get out of Iraq, I mean, I'll be long underground by then, and out of Afghanistan, there'll be someone else about to attack us. I think it's fascinating that we scream about drugs all the time, and the Taliban had no problem with drugs. Iraq has gone, or Afghanistan has gone from producing 12% of the world's drugs under our administration or intervention, it now produces 93% of the world's drugs. That, I mean, this is incredible. And of course, you and I know, and hopefully some of your more innocent listeners need to know, is that the drug operations of the world, the ones that are of any size at all, couldn't possibly function without powerful government intervention. The drug business on planet Earth was started, not locally, but internationally, by the British government, who used to publish right up through the 1920s, every single year, a report to the Queen totting up how much profit they had made from drug sales, breaking it down by the individual. How do I know that? For a nickel on the streets of New York from some book peddler about 12 years ago, I got this tatty little volume, maybe 80 pages, and it sat around my house for 10 years. When I finally opened it, my teeth fell out. It was the 1923 report to the Queen of England, how much money they had made from heroin, cocaine, marijuana, whatever, you know. They're the guys who did it. Every single, well, I can't say every single American fortune, but every single British fortune of any size either came from the slave trade or from drug dealing. I mean, that's it. The Roosevelt fortune came from drug dealing. It's very easy once you know that to track down the supporting documentation.
Well, and if you follow the American wars just in the 20th century, especially post-World War II wars, Korea, Vietnam, the South American military exploits, they all seem to coincide with a new drug trade or a new drug.
Isn't that ironic? And you mentioned earlier South Korea. Last year or the year before, I was the keynote speaker for South Korea's National Education Conference, and I spoke at Seoul University, which is their equivalent of Harvard, and I got a real dose of what school means to South Korea. It's our immediate future. It governs every waking thought. Is building some kind of a resume so you can trample on your neighbors. And Julius Caesar's divide and conquer, alive and well and living here in South Korea, almost anywhere you can think of that has a chance, you know, to live a lavish lifestyle, divide and conquer's the way it's done. That's why we give grades in school. Do grades add a single thing to your learning ability? I don't think so. But if they come equipped with promises of, you know, vague promises of other rewards, then perhaps, and they certainly keep kids from joining an alliance for in their common interests. They don't have common interests because ass-kissing is the way to get ahead. It's actually the way to get a good grade, too.
Well, and that's where the bell curve comes in, correct?
The bell curve, oddly enough, even though Freud and Gauss, I believe, first thought of it, the reason we hear the bell curve all the time is Charles Darwin's first cousin, Francis Galton, who was a crackerjack mathematician as well as many, many other fine mental developments. What Galton set his life's work at after Darwin had published, and his real important book is Descent of Man, not Origin of Species, that's a smokescreen, that once Descent of Man is published, Galton sets out for the rest of his life to travel the world, many trips to the United States. Galton creates a term, eugenics, which I hope still has enough currency that your listeners know it's a way to improve the breed. Well,
what was the national government that had a very strong military, started a big war? They used eugenics as their plan. What was the name of that government again?
Well, are you thinking of Prussia?
No, I was thinking more of the Nazi Germany. Is that how you say it?
Oh, they were. it's really, really interesting. They were pikers in a funny way. Nobody bothers to read the minutes of the Nuremberg trials. There was a special set of trials for the doctors who ran these ghastly experiments on masses of people. The doctors, to a person, you can get the testimony, you know, that box of candy your local librarian, she'll order it from somewhere, and in due time, you'll get the testimony of the doctors. Every single one of them says that the precedents they followed were United States precedents created at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory for Eugenics, which still is in existence, by the way.
And who was the major funder of the Cold Springs Laboratory?
Oh, Lord, let's see. There was the Harriman family, you know, the railroad fortune. Mrs. Harriman donated the land. The Carnegie Foundation was in over its head there. There was a German fund. I think it was the Pilgrim Fund, but don't hold me to that. Anyway, Cold Spring ran for years, and flying up the Hudson with a 40-foot swastika draped over both sides was either the Hindenburg or that other big Zeppelin they had. They lowered somebody over the side, and he presented a gold medal to the president of the Cold Spring Harbor thing for the gold medal. I used to know what the inscription on it was, but I don't recall that now. Eugenics, though, is the creation of Charles Darwin's first cousin, and more than that, he was brilliant. He was the chief global distributor of it. Japan changed its constitution in 1868. They just translated the Prussian constitution. They were the first people to put this scheme of universal schooling actually to work. There were laws for hundreds of years, but nobody ever could enforce the laws. Prussia did it in the good old-fashioned Prussian way at bayonet point. And delegations came from all over the world to study what Prussia has pulled off by sucking all the children out of the little homes and hovels and putting them in sheds with hired employees of the political state. Horace Mann went from the United States, and to take my excited tone down to a normal academic level, I'd like to document that in every public library in the United States. On the shelf, you're going to find Horace Mann's seventh letter to the Boston School Committee of 1843. It's one of the most important documents in American history because Mann begs Massachusetts to import the Prussian system and compel children to go to school. Over the next 50 years, every other American state followed suit.
On that note, there's an article that came out in the Los Angeles Times in March of this year that there was a ruling by the state appellate court that says that any homeschool teachers must have state teaching credentials.
Oh, Jesus. That they're not going to be able to enforce, and I'll tell you why. Michigan, 15 years ago, made that a law, exactly that a law, and one ex-nun became livid with rage, organized millions of people in the state of Michigan, and the state backed down. I've spoken probably 100 times for homeschooling groups in California, and they're not just your everyday 9-to-5 families. These are families that know how the system works. They tend to be upscale. They're completely activist. If that's a law, it won't remain a law.
Absolutely. Well, John, we want to keep talking here. Do you mind if we take a short, like, 3-minute break for a song and then come back and take some calls?
That sounds good, and I'll read an article from Rolling Stone about the American bubble economy.
Okay, great. We're gonna play a song, Craig. Everybody, we got John Taylor Gatto on the line here. We're gonna be taking calls in the next hour. Probably we'll announce it when it's time to take calls. We had a caller earlier from the 705 area code. Sorry, I didn't take your call, but we will take calls when we announce it. So please call back in when we announce. Everybody, I'm gonna play a song by a group. Actually, these people live just in a borough right next to you, John. You live on the island city of Manhattan, and these are some fellow New Yorkers. This is a group called Dead Prez from their album Let's Get Free, and the song is called They Schools.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Man, that school shit is a joke. The same people who control the school system control the prison system and the whole social system ever since slavery.
Some redneck crackers. Right around the time Third Base dropped the Cactus album, but I was reading Malcolm. I changed my name in 89, cleaning parts of my brain like a baby 9. I took a history class serious, front row, every day of the week, third period, fucking with the teacher's head, calling them racist. I tried to show them crackers some light, they couldn't face it. I got my diploma from a school called Rivers, full of teenage mothers and drug dealing niggas in the hallways. The popo was always present, searching through niggas' possessions, looking for dope and weapons. Get your lessons. That's what my moms kept stressing. I tried to pay attention, but their classes weren't interesting. They seemed to only glorify the Europeans, claiming Africans were only 3/5 of human beings.
They schools can't teach us shit. My people need freedom. We trying to get all we can get. All my high school teachers could suck my dick, telling me white man lies, straight bullshit.
That brainwash camp, they make you think if you drop out, you ain't got a chance to advance in life. They try to make you pull your pants up. Students fight.
fight the teachers and get took away in handcuffs. And if that wasn't enough, then they expel y'all. Your people's understanding, but to them, you a failure. Observation and participation, my favorite teachers. When they beat us in the hand with them books, it don't reach us. Whether you break dance or rock, sway to Adidas, or be in the bathroom with your clique smoking reefer, then you know they mad. Class ain't important unless you add enough cash and multiples. Unemployment ain't rewarding. They may as well teach us extortion. You either get paid or locked up. The principal is like a warden in the 4-year stint. Mad niggas never finish, but that doesn't mean I couldn't be a doctor or a dentist.
State schools can't teach us shit. My people need freedom. We're trying to get all we can get. All my high school teachers could suck my dick, telling me white man lies, straight bullshit. State schools can't teach us shit. My people need freedom. We're trying to get all we can get. All my high school teachers could suck my dick, telling me white man lies, straight bullshit. Bullshit.
Dead Prez with Dave
yeah,
Schools.
That
I picked
up.
That one out just for you, John.
Yeah, thank you, fellas.
Okay, so you wanted to read some article. We have a caller from 818. Caller, if you can be patient and just wait a few minutes, we'll open up the lines here in a few minutes to calls. But go ahead, John. What was the article you wanted to read?
Well, it's not an article. It's a statement by the Harvard professor who Harvard named its honor lecture in education after. So we can assume that Harvard thought a lot of this fellow. In 1917, he announced what the purposes of the newly intensified American public schooling system were. Now recall, as you're hearing these, there's six of them, that this is the guy who the honor lecture in education at Harvard's named after. He also was the children's book editor, no, the secondary school book editor of Houghton Mifflin's educational publishing arm. Okay, he said the very first thing that school is set up to do is to establish fixed habits of reaction to authority. Whether you learn, you know, English and social studies is distinctly peripheral to whether you develop fixed habits of reaction to authority. Now, if I gave you a quart of beer and I said, figure out a way to find out whether someone has actually developed fixed habits or whether they're just trying to fool me, it seems to me that by teaching large bodies of stupid information, sometimes completely inaccurate, and then testing whether people will parrot that back, that's a perfect test of fixed reaction to authority. The second function of schooling, according to this guy's name was Alexander Ingalls, although it's spelled I-N-G-L-I-S, people have to be made to conform, not to do a 1984 number on them, but because the economy depends on predicting what people are going to think and buy, and unless they've been homogenized to a certain kind of prescriptive conformity, you can't predict what they're going to do. The third function is called the diagnostic function. And Ingalls said, school is meant to determine each student's proper social role. And this is done by collecting a body of evidence, mathematically and anecdotally, that will follow you all your life and will force you to do what the school has predicted you're going to do. The fourth function is that children have to be trained only as far as their future destination in the social machine merits, and not one step further. The fifth function is probably the creepiest of all. That's called the selective function, and it refers not to human choice at all, but to Darwin's theory of natural selection. If you ever pick the book up, it says, the progress of the favored races. So, in short, the idea in school is to help things along by consciously attempting to improve the breeding stock. What you do is you pile labels, invidious labels, on the kids who want good breeding stock. That means all the Irish kids. And you humiliate them straight onward, and they'll be discouraged from taking on the responsibility of marriage and a family. And if that isn't the creepiest, the last one is the creepiest. Once this brilliant social system is established, you got to have some way to transmit it from generation to generation. Other than momentum, you have to have a directing intelligence, which means some of the kids have to be trained in what's actually going on. Now, it's true that they're not trained in public school, but they are trained in elite private boarding schools, and not all of them either. There are probably 20 that matter, and all the rest are pure bullshit. The 20 matter, interestingly enough, have produced a number of our presidential candidates in recent years. George Bush, everyone knows, went to Andover, but everyone doesn't know the guy he ran against went to St. Mark's in Washington. Those are two of the 20. Then if we go back to his father, obviously, but his father and son both ran against that Navy guy who's been trading on losing five airplanes. He's been trading on that for the rest of his life. McCain. McCain went to a school so elite that most people never heard of it, called Episcopal High School. I heard of it on the sports section, the New York Times, when a tiny little one-inch item said that 25,000 alumni had attended homecoming at Episcopal High School. I said, what? 25,000 people went to a high school football game? Anyway. So, it's a Latin word, the propaedeutic function, And that's the training of an elite group of caretakers for this system. These kids are quietly taught how to manage this continuing project, how to watch over and control a population deliberately dumbed down and declawed so that a government might proceed unchallenged and corporations might never want for obedient labor. Those didn't come from John Gatto. Those are six bald statements by the man the Harvard lecturer in education is named after.
Jesus Christ.
This stuff lays on the surface.
Hold on 1 second.
Not to see it. So there.
John, that's
sorry,
our vomiting sound effect.
I had to vomit a little bit there just thinking about that. So there's new world order conspiracies are going around left and right. There's been conspiracy theorists talking about this trained elite for years, and they're all seen as whack jobs and nutcases. And these words are from the mouth of the man who's the honor speaking series at Harvard is named after. This is arguably one of the most influential men in higher education. And of the higher education, and this is him laying out yet another dastardly plan.
Right. You can trace this lineage back. It didn't quite have the grip on things it has today. But if you take Mr. Engel, I got so interested in this guy that I did a little bit of research on his biography, and it turns out that during the American Revolution, his great-grandfather, I don't know, nine times removed or however long it would be, wrote a refutation to Tom Paine's Common Sense, the book that enhanced the Revolution. And then he fled from the colonies and was given a big job by the British in Nova Scotia. Then another one of his grandfathers was the head of the British Army against the Sepoy Mutiny in India. He's the guy who tied the Indians to the mouths of cannons, and blew them apart.
Jeez.
There. So he came from a whole long line of people who certainly had no patience with the evolutionarily retarded.
The Irish.
The Irish, yeah.
Oh, you got to read Darwin on the Irish. Because, I mean, he has some nasty things to say about the Spanish and the Italians, a number of other people. But when he gets to the Irish, he's eloquent, man. It's not an Irish, sir. He's evolving.
Well, hey, John, do you mind if we take a phone call?
Yeah, no, let's do that.
Okay, go, caller, I got you on the line here. Did you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I did until I heard that boring-ass dude talking. I think he's a teacher. That's the problem with education in the world right now, is boring-ass people. You need to catch the attention of the little kids coming up. Because when I was in school, I had boring-ass teachers like that. I had to smoke marijuana just to make me stay focused, you know? And it seems if you guys want to tackle the problem with education is grab the attention of the kids. You know what I mean? Don't throw a bunch of books that they don't understand in front of them. You know what I'm saying?
I think that we talked about that earlier, about boredom being the number one thing used by the school system to keep kids uninterested in learning and keep them in line.
I believe it. I dropped out really young. I went to prison. I learned more in prison than I did in school. Self-educated. Read a lot of books. Did a lot of stupid things, but you know I learned from them because they weren't boring.
Well, John, do you want to talk about that? I mean, this is pretty much, caller, I don't know if you're familiar with John,
teacher,
but this is pretty much what John talks about.
John is boring. He's what's wrong with society. John just rambles on about a bunch of literal stuff. That type of knowledge. But nobody understands him. You know what I mean? You got to talk on a sufficient level with these kids. You know, talk about, you know, like crack. You know, like heroin? Me, myself, I'm addicted to heroin. If you guys know, that's chicken and heroin. Half black, half white.
All right. Thanks, caller.
Because my mom didn't pay attention in school and didn't know not to sleep with black people.
Okay, thanks, caller.
This is the point. The point of the school factory is to turn out people who are either helpless or half-formed, who can't take care of themselves, who can't think clearly, who can neither write or speak very well, because if you can write or speak well, it's worse than being able to read well. You can recruit other people to your side if you can do those things. So school simply flatly ignores what used to be called the active literacies of writing and speaking. And the stuff you get to read is crap. But did anyone ever stop to think why you have to certify school teachers? I mean, isn't it apparent 15 minutes after you meet somebody whether they have something worthwhile to say, whether they know how to do something? Why aren't those people given open access to kids? Certainly in the first 200 years of American history, they were. And we certainly, for all our stumbles and mistakes, became a pretty muscular country. You've got to certify school teachers to make sure the good people who think for themselves and know how to do something can't get through the screen. A few of them do, and then you can get rid of them during the tenure period of time. But for the most part, I love school teachers. It's the hardest job in the world, and many of them have good hearts. But essentially, you got to pass through a teacher education program, and nobody with any self-confidence or imagination or even self-respect would do that. I mean, not forge your license. I taught for my first year on a borrowed teaching license that probably was technically stolen. I had a roommate who had a teaching license. He taught one day, came home, threw the license in the drawer. He said, "You got to be a fucking imbecile to do that for a living." He became a waiter at the Waldorf Astoria, was making $1,000 a night, saved up enough money, went to the Virgin Islands and opened a fancy restaurant down there in a hotel called the Club Comanche. It's still open. Dick's passed away. So he moves out and goes to the Virgin Islands. There's his license sitting in the drawer. I was an advertising copywriter, and often the accounts leave and you're laid off. I said, "Oh, hey, I'll use his license and substitute teach." I did that for a year and signed his name to the checks.
I have a real quick question. Did that caller tell us he was addicted to heroin?
I couldn't understand much of it. I don't mean that disrespectfully.
That caller was just calling to start shit. We get that sometimes, John. Interestingly enough, I actually like getting calls like that. And
hell
the reason
yeah.
is, it's a pulse, it's a finger on the pulse of how people act when they're caught up in the system internally. And you talk about that a lot. What you kind of talk about is fascism doesn't rule with a boot anymore. It rules with the book, with the teacher's book, and how the student tends to become his own master in that he polices himself or herself.
Of course. For really meaningless rewards. That's the interesting thing. You know, with a piece of paper or, a choice of a so-called better. I mean, the payoff is tiny, and what you have to do is surrender your spirit, your soul. You have to become what someone wants you to become.
Well, John, I have a question for you. What are some ideas that you have, in your 30 years of teaching? What are some ways that you can advise people to work around the system, to undermine it? Because people do feel trapped in the system, and they come to accept it like Stockholm Syndrome. So what are some ways that you could offer for people to begin?
Yeah, tell us about Bartleby.
One way is simply to retreat back to the beginnings and to look at the education that the most powerful families in the world administered over their own children. I mean, it's a genuine eye-opener, and what they do doesn't really cost a cent. It's true, for example, that you may not be able to afford a horse and its room and board there, and horseback riding is a great way to develop courage, self-confidence, you know, daring, all those good things. But you can do it in an absolutely cheap way. You can walk to Miami Beach and back. So there are analogs to all the things that the great families through history have done to create leadership imagination in their own kids. When I say, look at what a classical education is, I don't mean to be hoity-toity. A classic education scorns the idea of subjects. They don't exist in the real world. And if you're hooked on getting a higher grade in math or science or social studies, you're out of your goddamn mind. What you need to do is a palette of characteristics that you would like to possess in your life. Courage, imagination, resiliency, whatever
adventure
they are. That means about 200 of these adjectives, and we'd like to have them all, but there's not enough time in a life. Pick the ones you want to concentrate on, and then even if it's making $1 billion, even if it's that contemptible purpose, but then say what exercises are likeliest to lead me closer to that. I mean, in 30 years of school teaching, I would say that maybe 25% of the kids I confronted, rich and poor, were absolutely mute. They had such a bad opinion of themselves, they were unable to speak articulately in public. They just couldn't do it. Now, there's a condition that's going to condemn you through your life. You cannot escape it. You'll be taken advantage of over and over again. That's what that person ought to be concentrating on. And it doesn't require a certified expert to say what would overcome that, and nor does it require some kind of cockamamie child development specialist. You're only going to learn to be at ease speaking to all kinds of people by doing that. Now, I could get more rarefied and lay down principles, but basically that's what you've got to do, no matter how much it hurts. There is no cure for it unless you do that. Now, you can ask other people, help me in this situation. I can only sustain this for 5 minutes or whatever. And similarly, you know, I'll make a rash statement. Making money is one of the easiest things in the world, and really making large amounts of it. You have to sacrifice, really, all of your life, but it's not very hard to do. My grandfather, I couldn't have been 7 years old. My grandfather said to me, making money's easy. He said, I ran a printing shop. He said, you got to find out what other people want and then either give it to them cheaper than anybody else, give it to them better than anyone else, or be the only one offering it in your region. He said, that's all there is to it. Now, notice that the fundamental premise is you got to find out what other people want. You can't do that copying notes off a blackboard, but you absolutely can do that wandering around the streets and in and out of institutions, watching people, pretending to participate in the general. You're watching, you're overhearing conversations, and you're putting together. I had a 13-year-old girl who made, oh, God, I had $5,000 or $6,000 in a month. She lived in Harlem, mind you. And she said, my mother says, I can go to Paris by myself, I can make the money, but and this is 30 years ago, 40 years ago. But she said, no, nobody can make that kind of money at 13. I said, sure you can. Can't make it delivering groceries. You start a business. Kids can't start businesses. Oh, my God, I said, all through history, it's easier to start a business with a kid than any other way because you can get inside people's defenses. I said, cut school for a month. I'll cover. I'll mark you prison. Tell the other teachers you're doing a project at Columbia University. And, you know, wander around and find a well-defined public that will tell you what they want. And she comes back to me after about 2 weeks, and she says, I'm hanging around. This is a 13-year-old girl. I'm hanging around Barnard College, you know, probably with all the incidentals. Probably costs about $100,000 a year to go to Barnard. She said, and I'm listening in the cafeteria pretending to drink a, you know, soda. I'm listening. These girls are bitching that they don't want to go back home on Christmas, but they want to find an unusual gift, and there's no such thing that all the stores sell carbon copies of what all the other stores are selling. Boy, if someone could only find a set of unusual gifts so we could soft soap our mothers and then let us stay in New York City and screw around, probably literally, you know, for the holidays. And she said to me, there's 48 old age homes on the west side of Manhattan. People think those are all broken down old people, but they cost $4,000 or $5,000 a month. He said, these have to be people who've been somebody who are in these homes, you know, and they can paint and they can sew and photograph, whatever else. She said, I'm going to set up a business where they make one-of-a-kind gifts. I'll split 50-50 with them. They manufacture. I'll sell. And I'll put the lady's picture on the gift with a little biography there. She did a land office business. And she decided after her freshman year in college to drop out, hitchhike to Florida, catch a ride on a private airplane up the Amazon River, and she wrote, anyone listening now can track this girl and her book down. She wrote a book at the age of 19 called Damn the Rivers, Damn the People, about the Brazilian government's habit of building dams in the middle of nowhere where nobody needed a dam, and it ruined the traditional life of the tribes above the dam and below the dam. Her name is B.J. Cummings, C-U-M-M-I-N-G-S. Damn the Rivers, Damn the People. The World Wildlife Foundation published that she was 19, and out of that she got an all-expenses-paid Ph.D. at some California college or other. You know, I mean, the world really is an abundant set of opportunities, but not if you line up respectfully waiting for somebody to give
you. Well, what do you recommend, since we are a culture based on listening to a teacher tell us what to do? Can you tell us what to do? You have the Bartleby
partly.
Project.
I can
you have the Bartleby
you
Project.
Partly what to do. But what I'll tell you is what every major philosopher in human history said. There isn't any variation from this at all. You start by knowing yourself. Well, you don't know yourself by asking other people how I am. You put yourself at risk in a number of situations. You see how you respond. You'd make a calculated gamble whether if you stuck at it, you could get better. If not, you drop that line of advance. You got to know yourself. You can't know yourself by only speaking to people who are easy for you to speak to because they're just like you, and you all nod your heads at one another. You end up marrying each other, you know, and having kids who hate you. It happens every day to almost everybody. So you've got to have raw experience first, because words don't mean anything. The word democracy means nothing at all from the dictionary definition. You have to see it in action to know what it means. And, of course, Obama's democracy and Bush's democracy are two different things. The word's the same. The concepts are different. You've got to have a lot of raw experience. Did anybody bother to tell either of you or anyone listening that in countries like Sweden, you're not allowed to go to school to age 7? They won't take you in at 5. There's no such thing as pre-kindergarten. I wrote a letter many years ago to someone in Sweden. I remember her name was Gunilla there. And I said, why do you do this? And I wrote back and she said, the Swedish government is not prepared to pay the high price for the pathologies that develop when somebody's taken into these communal experiments too early. She said, so 7 plus before the age of 12, if you're lucky enough to live in Sweden, the government will underwrite a year off school for you to go and, I don't know, do tomb rubbings over in Egypt or something. You submit your design.
We got another caller on the line.
Sure. I hope he's more articulate than the last guy.
I can guarantee she is. This is one of my favorite radio show hosts on Blog Talk Radio. Sister Michelle, are you there?
Yes, I am. Peace and blessings, everyone.
Thank you. Welcome to the show.
Sister Michelle hosts the Wake Up Call show, everybody, just so you know. What's your comment or question?
Well, I had a comment and a question, actually. My comment is I wanted to know, John, what your take was on corporate punishment in schools, because, you know, there's a lot of schools now, well, not now, but always has been, that allowed the policy to have corporal punishment in the schools, even against parents' consent. And this is one of the things that we're really trying hard to get a bill passed in each and every state to stop this, because it's nothing but, you know, to me, it's a form of, it's an abuse that has been, to me, since slavery, it's been there, and now we're continuing this sort of thing, especially in minority schools, especially in schools that, you know, parents aren't educated to what the effects are of corporal punishment.
I hear you, Michelle, and let me say, without any attempt to be a wise guy, that when you force somebody's attendance and you threaten to jail their parents and put the kid in social work, that's the worst kind of corporal punishment. Then if you allow school teachers have exactly one way other than the affection of their students to maintain discipline. After all, think of the dynamics. You have 30 different kids from all over the place, from all different kinds of backgrounds, jammed in a room like rats. When a bell rings, the only way most teachers have to enforce discipline is to use the weapon of humiliation. And I have been struck very, very hard. I went to Catholic school where pain long and strong was the way to keep order, and I've been in schools where the way is to humiliate the kids. And I'll tell you that personally, I would much prefer to be struck, and I'm not advocating that people strike children, but than to be humiliated. And yet your group has no way to stop teachers from humiliating kids. And if you did have a way to stop teachers from doing that, what would happen is the lid would almost literally come off the school, because you're doing an unnatural thing. You're forcing people to be where they don't want to be. You're breaking time into a prison of measured units. And furthermore, you're not teaching kids what they want to know. Let me give you an example of something I did with the most amazing success than anyone else could do it. I was hired as an English teacher, but in very short order, I realized that I had been hired to keep these kids quiet and orderly, and nobody cared whether I taught English well or poorly. So what I did was I would ask kids on the first day of the term, I would say, I want you to, I passed out file cards, I said, tell me three things, even illegal things like building a gun or how to get your hands on, tell me three things you would like to learn this year. Then tell me three weaknesses you have that you'd like to overcome, and tell me three strengths you have. I'll use the strengths to find places for you all around New York City that will help you build on those strengths. And what we'll use the class time for, we'll just lie to the school administration. We'll use the class time individually to work on your weaknesses and to fulfill your wishes, and at least one of your three wishes, you know, because I had 120 kids in a year. It worked just spectacularly well, spectacularly well. And not that I wish to become the friend of 120 kids a year, or, you know, because it adds up. It ends up to no time left for you. But nevertheless, I did become, I'm in touch with, I haven't taught now in a school since 1991, so it's 16 years. I'm probably in touch with 300 of the 4,000 or 5,000 kids. And they've hunted me down, and, you know, we're friends now. But corporal punishment, the worst kind, is to steal someone's time. And you're not intending to do anything about that. The second worst time is to humiliate somebody. And the third is probably to strike somebody. But I must say this to you, Michelle. It's not an easy question to deal with. If you look at elite education all over the world, I mean, these are the Duke sons, et cetera, et cetera. It's riddled with corporal punishment.
Yeah, but the thing is, the physical part is more harmful as far as, you know, the harm that it causes to children. I mean, I understand what you're saying about, you know, the psychosocial part, but that whole restraint, seclusion, the actual physical hitting, all it does is create more violence within the school.
That,
it doesn't cure violence.
True. And I believe that.
Is it a coincidence that the same states now that host corporal punishment are the same states that hosted lynchings legally? It's the same exact states. I mean, is that not odd to any of us? Look at the top 10 lynching states. That, you know, you can Google it and look at them. They're the same exact states that now.
For that. But I will tell you that in the high school I went to in western Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh, every single classroom had a large paddle mounted over the door with things written on the paddle, and some of the paddles had a battery attached. They were cattle prods. I remember the gym teacher would take you into the shower and then uses electrified paddle on you. It certainly was a memorable experience, and I don't think anyone has a right to violate someone else, but I would strongly disagree with you that physical punishment is anywhere near as harmful as psychological punishment. And my evidence, but I wish we had a pot of tea and, you know, could sit and talk peacefully together. But my evidence is that the schools for the wealthiest children in the world, I mean every country of industrial wealth in the world, the schools for the wealthy are riddled with forms of corporal punishment that you and I would think are horrifying. And the reason for that is quite rational. It may be wrong, but it's quite rational. The idea is that if you're bothered by a little bit of pain, you're going to be a loser all your life. And so, look, I interviewed about 20 years ago the admissions officer at Princeton University. He gave me a half an hour, and I said, what on a resume do you look at first? I said, is it standardized test scores or grades? We don't look at those at all, he said. We don't look at those. I said, well, what do you look at? Well, we look at hobbies first. And I said, hobbies, I've been told to leave hobbies off a resume because no one looks at them. On the contrary, he said, they're the only way you can get a window into the kid's heart because it's the only time he has or she has that they're free to spend your time as you want. And I said, well, what hobbies do you look for? He said, well, we want balance. We look for an intellectual hobby, a physical hobby, and a social hobby. A physical hobby, I said, you mean like football or basketball? Well, he said, if you can't do anything else. I said, what do you mean? Those are team sports. Exactly, he said. You can hide behind your teammates in those sports, so they're not a good index. He said, a single-person sport where your body or even your life is at risk is by far the best, like sailing a one-person sailboat out of sight of land or jumping a horse or riding trail riding, because if you don't know what you're doing, you're dead or crippled. He said, we want people who can master themselves and their fear. We're looking for leaders, not followers. I tell you, it was such an eye-opener to me. And then 3 years ago, I got to interview the admissions director at Harvard. It's a woman, or was a woman then, at least. And she said, it was the same thing. She said, grades and standardized test scores are not a good way to detect excellence. And we only allow people in Harvard who have a record of excellence, not the potential, but a record. Well, what on earth do you mean? She said, well, she said, have you started a business? Have you started a charity? Have you written a book? You know, have you sold a song? And on. She said, the people who are going to rule the world are people who've already shown a record before they're 18. I want to give you a couple of examples because you'll recognize them. Tiger Woods was putting on television on the Mike Douglas Show when he was 2 years old. Richard Branson, who didn't go to high school or college, Branson at age four was being dropped miles from his home by his mother in London, which is the craziest city on earth, and he had to find his way back home by himself. Age four, mind you. I'll leave it with those two, but I have a long list of other people. There's a tremendously influential black artist traveling the world right now. Her name is Kara Walker, K-A-R-A, and then Walker. The New Yorker magazine interviewed Kara Walker. She was doing a major exhibit in a Paris museum about 2 years ago. And she does these 40-foot wall paintings about the sexual exploitation of slaves. And they're really, I mean, you can't, you'll never forget them if you see them. They're so vivid. Well, her production assistant is her four-year-old daughter. And while she was being interviewed by the New Yorker 2 years ago, the little girl began to pull on her dress. She was really annoyed. The interview had gone on for an hour. And when Kara looked at her daughter, Octavia said, Kara Walker, when is it going to be my turn? That's what we do wrong with kids. History has shown you're a man and a woman at the age of 12. You are not a young man or a young woman, I mean, the first admiral in the American Navy was in charge of a warship at age 12. George Washington, when asked what the two most influential things he had learned in his life were that had served him in good stead, he said ballroom dancing and horseback riding. He said horseback riding gave me a seat that drew the admiration of my officers and men to me because I was the best rider they'd ever seen. And ballroom dancing gave me a posture and a presence where when I walked into a room, everyone stopped talking. It's not interesting. That's from Washington. You know, we've ignored the lessons of history. I mean, that you're a man or a woman at age 12, or otherwise you've been hideously brought up.
I gotta say, we haven't ignored the lessons of history, John. We've had them hidden from us.
Oh yes, yes. But good as knows. I grew up during the Second World War. And in third or fourth grade, I learned about Admiral Farragut, and I learned about this endless number of people who had made a mark by the age of 10, 12, 15. At age 15, having run away from home with his mother's permission, Thomas Edison was out in Michigan, 1,000 miles from his home in New Jersey, all on his own, at the age of 12, and by the age of 15, he had 3 prosperous businesses going, none of them dependent on an invention. That came a little later when he invented the electric light, the phonograph, and 1,001, literally that many, other inventions. But he flunked out of school at age 7. His mother was told he was too stupid ever worth wasting time on in school. You ought to learn a trade. So
before we go on with this, while we're on this subject, we have a caller on the line who we usually play a segment by this caller every week called This Week in Radical History, where he goes through the dates of the week and picks out a moment in history that we're not taught about of radical history. And you focused a lot on your book, Weapons of Mass Instruction, about the success stories, the financial success, the corporate success stories of dropouts. But I think that one thing that we're drastically missing in history is our history lessons in radical history, the ones who made vast amounts of change in their own way using direct action of various sorts. And so I want to bring on Mike Cannon for just a few minutes here. He's going to give us This Week in Radical History lesson. So, Mike, are you there?
Yeah, sure am, guys. Great show again, as always. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Welcome to the show. It's nice to meet you.
So what do you got for Cannon fodder this week, Mr. Cannon?
Got a few things, but just to remind everybody, I do a 20 to 25-minute show every week, and it can be found on radioforall.net, including some other stations that posted. I'm working on the final edit for tonight.
And that's radioforall.net, the number 4, radioforall.net.
Yeah, same place that you post your great show, too, so you can always catch both our shows on that place if you want to listen to the rewind version of it. And so I'm just going to give you a couple highlights of some stuff that kind of stuck out in my brain from this week. It should be just a couple minutes here. First, for August 30th, on 1958, we all might remember that Fidel walked into the woods with about, 7, 9 guys, and he came walking out and kicked out the U.S. Mafia-controlled government of Cuba. So I think that's a little bit of history that's kind of nice to remember. Also, for August 31st, in 1970, Philadelphia raid of the Black Panthers and coin pro coral stuff with Wesley Cook, also known as Mool al-Jamal, who is now on death row. So that's when his harassment kind of started officially.
That's right.
And then also on September 1st, 1987, San Francisco, S. Brian Wilson tried stopping an arms shipment to the Contras, an illegal arms shipment to the Contras, and he lost both his legs trying to do that, I think on a railroad trestle or something. So. A good, brave man there. He never regretted his action, from what I understand from history. September 2nd, 1872, Hague Congress, the first international, was held, where Marx and Engels were trying to destroy the international rather than to allow anti-authoritarian elements, i.e. the anarchists, from trying to do their agenda.
So, fuck them.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Engels. Fuck you, Marx. We're still here.
Yep. Well, Bakunin was a big, and Marx were big giant rivals, and obviously Marx got the upper hand on that. Now, that happened in 1872, another little bit of history.
And should be noted, both Bakunin and Marx were upper-class citizens.
Absolutely. They sure were. So a lot
yeah.
of people...
So fuck them anyway. More rich white guys. Fuck them both.
A little more history, a couple more items. Also for September 2nd, 1993, San Francisco mayor arrests Food Not Bombs for feeding the homeless in San Francisco. Can't be doing that now, can we? September 3rd, anti-war, this is kind of a nice one, anti-war, I forgot what year this was, but anti-war protester, I think it was for World War One or Two. Protester in Australia, a wobbly named Tom Baker, put a posters up including the words that said, "Workers, follow your masters, stay at home." And for that, he got 12 months in hard labor. But here's the cool thing about it, and this is the kind of things that also motivate me. All of a sudden, for the next 3 months, a bunch of factories and stores started to kind of light on fire in Australia. So they gave early release 9 months early. So it's shown
coincidence theory.
Yeah, coincidence. Very coincidental. So. More items. September 5th, Crazy Horse, 1877, who had surrendered in May, was assassinated with bayonets to the back by U.S. soldiers in one of the military camps that they're holding them. So, once again, showing the side of the U.S. military. September 5th, 1917, of course, was the famous Palmer Raids began, where they started arresting wobblies and anarchists without warrants. Berkman and Emma Goldman were sent to Russia, amongst a bunch of other people, for this mass deportation. And it was also the largest mass arrest in U.S. history ever happened. Also, of course, a couple of years ago, Common Ground Collective organized in after the Katrina hit, and it was kind of, at least it started out as a pretty radical alternative, pretty much the only thing that was offering any kind of services to the Lower Ninth Ward for literally months.
And that was started by a Black Panther named Malik Rahim.
Black Panther guy, Malik Rahim, yep, he was a great guy. He started with $50 and a bunch of people. So I'm going to give a quick plug. If you're concerned about radical responses to emergency disasters out there, aftershockaction.org is a organization that I belong to. We're organizing radical responses to those kind of emergency situations again. So that's aftershockaction.org. And my last little bit of radical history for this week, September 6, 1901. Of course, McKinley was shot by an anarchist. Police claim that it was anarchist Emma Goldman's lecture that motivated the anarchist to shoot McKinley and assassinate him, arrested her, but then released her later. So words, I guess, are dangerous. So those are a little bit of tidbits of stuff that's going to be on my show again, which is on radioforall.net. Will be posted in a couple hours to that spot.
All right.
Okay,
thanks,
Mike.
A lot,
thanks
Mike.
So much.
We're going to do – we got about 7 minutes left. I'm going to hit one quick free commercial. It's about a minute long, a little less, and then we'll do closing statements from John. Is that cool with you, John?
Fine.
Okay, great. This is a free commercial I'm going to play that was sent to me by Nate Jugazi, and this is pertinent to right now, the swine flu, everybody. Yeehaw.
Remember the swine flu scare of 1976?
The Obama administration is considering implementing a new vaccination program against the flu, a plan that would require Americans to get not one, not two, but flu shots.
30,000 to 90,000 people could die.
Most commonly, human cases of swine flu happen in people who
fight the pigs.
The U.S. government told us all that swine flu could turn out to be a
state-sponsored false flag terrorism
that could spread across the nation.
And the whole thing causes autism.
So that's the swine flu free commercial. Free commercials are... things that sell you nothing but ideas. And I got one quick short clip I want to play for you, John, and for the listeners, that this is John Kerry, and this is pretty great. Well, if the FBI will allow me to play it. Hey, Big Brother, this is Little Brother. I don't care if you're watching. I'm going to fuck you up anyway. Let me play my clip. Never mind. Basically, it's Kerry saying that if you do poorly in school, if you do good in school, you get sent to run businesses. If you do poorly in school, you get sent to Iraq.
That's word.
So, John, thank you so much for coming on. Can you give us a closing statement here?
A student at Yale, and in fact, George Bush had a higher average at Yale. Kerry's average was 75, and Bush's was 76.
Well, then that proves the point, because Bush didn't go to war and Kerry did, so. So fuck him.
St. Paul's, which next to Groton is probably the single most elite private boarding school in the country.
Hello?
Are we all still here?
John, you there?
Could I tell the listeners how to buy my book? If you don't buy my
please
book,
do.
We're going to starve to death.
You tell them how to buy it, and I'll tell them where they can steal it from places that already bought it. Does that work?
All right. Well, if they go to my website, www.johntaylorgatto.com, Taylor's T-A-Y-L-O-R, Gatto's G-A-T-T-O, not only can they buy Weapons of Mass Destruction there, and Dumbing Us Down if they haven't read that one, but I have a $35 book I wrote called The Underground History of American Education. It's completely every word, every period, and semicolon. It's up there on the website. You can read it on the website, or you can download it, or you can, in fact, buy it off the website.
All right. I will say that Borders and Barnes & Noble have both ordered multiple copies of your book, because they're really good books, especially Weapons of Mass Destruction I'm reading now. I've read Dumbing Us Down. It's a great book. It's a great, basically a primer for most homeschoolers is Dumbing Us Down. It's the one that invigorates most homeschoolers. And if that doesn't do it, Weapons of Mass Destruction in the first 20 pages will piss you off to the point. We actually, after reading the first 14 pages of Weapons of Mass Destruction, we decided to pull our child out of school, and we've begun a homeschool curriculum just this week.
Oh, wow.
So I mean, you've just changed the lives of my two children and all of the lives that they're going to affect, and the lives of myself and my wife, because the biggest part of homeschooling is learning, and I'll be learning a lot as I'm homeschooling and unlearning, uneducating, unschooling.
It'll be a grand experience.
I'm really excited about it. But Borders and Barnes & Noble have multiple copies of your books there. And they've already bought them from you, so they have very poor security at Borders and Barnes & Noble.
And, John, we want to thank you so much for being on the show and staying with us so long. It's been a real pleasure having you.
Thank you. Will you tell your friend who does the radical moment about my lecture being closed down at Highland High School in Hudson, New York, by the local police? They burst into the auditorium, terminated my lecture, and all I was doing was giving the grade point averages of prominent citizens and CEOs, and I wasn't doing it.
What was the date on that? When was that, John?
A chapter in Weapons of Mass Destruction about the details of that, but I think that belongs in the radical statements when a broken down junior high school teacher's lecture is shut down by the police.
Absolutely. Oh, man. John, it has been such an honor to have you on the show tonight. And I don't say that in a kiss-ass way. I say that in the way that being a high school dropout, my greatest teachers have been the people I talk to personally, not the books that I've read. So I always make an effort to reach out to anybody who's influenced me in writing, to talk to them personally to make sure that that they're legit. And after having conversations this week with you on the phone and tonight, I gotta say, man, you're too legit to quit, John. Too legit to quit.
Thank you. Are you guys gonna give me an air check of this?
What's that?
The 2 hours we just did.
An air check?
Well, you know, either a cassette or a DVD or a CD.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I'll download it and burn it onto a disc and send it to you. And speaking of which, if you're just tuning in, you can download this segment after it's recorded. I'm going to upload it onto radioforall.net, where I also upload Anarchy Now, where Mike Cannon uploads his weekly This Week in Radical History, and you can download it there. So, yeah.
I'll say goodnight to you because Edmund is just coming on, and I wouldn't want to miss that as a good American. Take care, guys. And
take care, John.
Peace
Thanks,
and
John.
Blessings.
Yes.
You too. Thank you.
you,
so everybody, that's one of my favorite living anarchist perspectives ever, I think. I think John Taylor Gatto's fucking phenomenal. What'd you think, G20? Hey.
Oh man, I love that guy. He's like the drunk grandpa that you just can't wait to go visit. You know what I'm saying? Love that fucking guy.
Yeah, he was amazing. Everybody tune in next week. We're gonna have, next week is the anniversary, Travis and I's anniversary of marriage, not to each other, but to our wives. Both of us got married on September 6th, and not together. It's kind of weird. But we did it so we could wife swap and still not miss anniversaries.
Gross.
But so we won't be on next week. We're going to have guest hosts. The guest host is Reverend Dr. Mason Bilderberg. Played his free commercials on here. He's a co-host on Anarchy Now. He's a badass motherfucker, so tune in, everybody. In the meantime, fight a cop and make love to somebody.
Okay.
All right. One love.
Yep. See you next week, guys.